a beautiful time dialoguing and sharing. God was able to minister to those, and hope you was uplifted and edified and encouraged. And that's what we're here for. And again, continue to keep listening to WFT 90.1 FM. God's will. We'll see you next week right here on Power and Praise.
Down the railroad track, it makes me feel so doggone blue to listen to that old smokestack. Drivers are rolling on, leaving me here behind. Give me back them good old days and let me ramble down the line. Lonesome train, I love to hear the whistle blow. She's taking the sun and leaving the rain and making me want to go. I've got the blues, longing for her company. Many miles from where I am to the only one for me. It's so lonesome here, waiting for the manifest. I hope that engineer is kind enough to let me be his guest. Pal to me, take me everywhere I want to go, get my transportation free.
Go.
This is Dave Monkey Prairie Monk, WEFT Champagne 90.1 on your FM dial.
And Dave on the board.
And it's pledge drive, and we need to do something about pledge drive. We had a very nice evening yesterday with WEFest. I thought it went well, and you might have some comment on that. Don might have some. We have a guest, Don Davis.
Hello, my name is Don Davis. Yeah, I do the Tuesday morning jazz. But I thought it was one of the best WEFest we've had in years on a number of levels.
Yes.
And, of course, you know, we are in a pledge drive, so money was it was nice that people were a little bit more open. It was a good time in the in the beer garden next door.
Yeah,
good food, good.
And
really good music. Everybody was good. You know, I liked everybody yesterday, which means they were all good, if I like them, right?
I was giving tours of the Pocket Prairie, and it was good. So we are in Pledge Drive, and this program is a little bit unique in that we work with Banner Public Television and put it up on television twice a week and then up on YouTube. So we're doing something different. And but you need to support that. This is community action. If I have to talk to people to get the guests to come in to for them to understand what WEFT is about, what we might want them to say, and hopefully they will say something that's of very great interest to you. That costs time and money, and we have to have the appropriate equipment that will do that. So If you can donate a small amount of money, that helps us keep going.
If you can donate a large amount of money, that would help us keep going,
yes.
too.
Well, some money came in from the festival yesterday.
Oh, yes. That's what I say. It was good to see Wefty here go up the tower.
Yes. In passing, we usually say something about local people who have contributed in a very fancy manner often. And we like to report on that so that you as another generation will know that it's possible for you to do interesting things. So Joyce Curtis passed, and she was born in Wisconsin, but grew up in Bement, and graduated in commerce, married a Bement farmer, who had been in the forces for a while. She degreed in commerce and supported the family while Paul, her husband of 60 years before that, got a higher degree. And they have family there. You know the pumpkin patch, and you know the orchard. It's Curtis Orchard. It's very near to Curtis Road on Dungan Road, and we wish the family well in this passing. We also want to register that this family has for years supported the Rattlesnake Master Run for the Prairie, which comes every year in early November, November the 6th in this year. So it's seed picking time. We need to pick, especially ceanothus, which is a fairly rare plant that's not easy to put in a row and cultivate and grow in a harvestable manner. So you have to pick it, because sometimes the seed is ripe and green on the same plant at the same time. So this is a natural history way of survival, but it is not, doesn't help the harvest of it with a mechanical means where you expect all the seed to come ripe at the same time. We'll do that at Camp Creek. We had a 4-H group that wanted to do that on Friday, but it rained. But we can use help if you would like to call 840-1911. 840-1911. On Saturday, between 11:30 and 1:30, we'll have iHelp students at Rantoul to also pick seed. In this case, it's Lietris mostly. And we're looking for leaders, because we need people who are naive pickers to know what seed to pick and how to pick it. If you pull Lietris up, you milk it fairly firmly, you'll also pull up the corm that supports the plant. So after years of trying to get those corms going, we ask for people to gently pick. So that a few leaders is very, very helpful. Just talk to people. And to some extent, these are students who are encountering a prairie for the first time. George Foster has a retrospective. He's an art professor that has passed, but his artwork is on display. I think it's called Gallery 217 on University Avenue, just south of the city building in Champaign. I'm looking for a surveyor's blaze, a little log that was sitting out in front of Weft, and it has disappeared, and it's sort of a historic monster. When you didn't have too many objects like stones or buildings, early settlers had to have a survey, and this blaze is where you cut the bark of a tree and it wells, but doesn't well completely, and leaves a blaze, which is called a monument for surveyors, and that's a little bit of history that we have and keep around locally. And now we have a guest, Don Davis, and he He is an inveterate wanderer on the Appalachian Trail, and he's been doing that over summer, but he also went to Mount Kilimanjaro in Africa, and that's on the border of Tanzania and Kenya. And so I'll leave that to Don to tell us.
Tanzania, just like an Australian. Uh-huh. Tanzania.
Tanzania.
Yeah. But no, it's both pronunciations. I heard both while I was there. Uh-huh. And of course, I heard it in the native Swahili as well.
So how high is this mountain?
It is 5,895 meters.
So it doesn't have much snow on it or anything?
It has a little bit, but a lot less than the pictures and the posters around town and around the world have of it. It's amazing how glaciers all over the world. I've gone to 3 different glacier parks in the last 5 or 6 years, and all of them are much, much smaller than my childhood. So, yeah. Glacier National, New Zealand.
The Australians have a small Mount Kosciuszko,
which is their highest peak.
Yes.
In
it has a little bit of snow too.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, that's one of the what we call the 7 summits, the the 7 highest peaks in each of the continents around the world.
The Australian Mount Kosciuszko gets.
This is, by the way, for those of you watching on TV, I have to have audio feedback in my voice. I can't tell how I'm talking. I can't talk because I'll start doing this and it just nobody can hear or understand.
And I have to dodge the superstructure which comes across one's face. I'm not even sure whether I'm on camera at all at the moment.
Yeah, since we are an audio medium, you get this audio feedback by putting it on headphones. Yeah. They're not the... you know, they don't do the best for my hair, make me look good on video, but that's okay.
The Australian peak is the 7th wonder of the world because the rain clouds come across Australia and go up and drop rain on what is...
As a matter of fact, of the 7 summits, Kilimanjaro, of course, is the one that gets visited the most and climbed the most. Even though Kosciuszko is only about 2,600 meters, there is some technical climbing. And also, the farther you get away, I didn't know this until I was there, the farther away you get away from the equator, the lower the oxygen level comes at higher atmospheres. So because of the barometric pressure that you get at the northern and southern latitudes. So Mount Kosciuszko, actually, even though it's much, much lower than Kilimanjaro, tends to be... First of all, you have to have technical climbing ability to get up to the top.
Uh-huh.
So there is snow and crampon work there and that sort of stuff.
The Australian situation is not so much a climbing situation. It's hydroelectric. You put dams, and so fast-moving water that moves out onto the coast is dammed. And
that's very valuable.
It goes west through... Western rivers.
Yeah, we do the same in this country, too. As a matter of fact, the other thing I did this summer was hike through the mountains of Virginia. And, of course, the one thing I remembered about Virginia when I hiked the AT before, and it really hit me again, is the number of high-tension wires, kilowatt and megawatt.
Oh, so they're using...
And now they're making gigawatt lines, so...
Uh-huh. That's been the real problem with electricity is getting grids.
Well, getting the electricity to the population centers that need it from where it's made by, by running water.
So does Kilimanjaro have water? and does it have hydro?
No, as a matter of fact, it's a really interesting environment.
It's
because
a bit
when you start out, it is definitely equatorial. In the sense that you are walking in a rainforest. I mean, it is green, beautiful green. There are monkeys. Oh. There are all sorts of animals that live at the base.
Birds.
Oh, lots of beautiful birds, yeah. Yeah, and I say in macaws and baboons and all sorts of animals live there. The only two animals that actually go all the way up the hill or go up even halfway up the hill are hyenas and a water buffalo, which we didn't run into, or Cape buffalo of some sort.
Uh-huh.
And we didn't run. I heard hyenas at night, but I never saw either one.
Take us through the ecosystem as you go up.
Yeah.
It seems to me that the rainforests are lower down, and is the top kind of barren?
It's very barren. It is lunar.
So take us through the steps. Okay. There's probably four or five different...
So when you start, you're already at about 4,000 feet. Hmm. And remember, you're going up to about 19,400 feet is the top.
Uh-huh.
So you're starting at about 4 in the town of Moshi and going up from there. And again, it's summertime there. It's, you know, 80 degree. Well, I expect it to be hotter and more humid, but it was actually quite pleasant. It was 80 or so during the day.
So it's below the equator?
It's slightly below the equator.
Oh, okay.
Only a couple of degrees. The difference between summer and winter in terms of the amount of light is like 15 minutes a day.
Yes.
Because, you know, the sun only moves a little bit up north, a little bit south.
So it's administered by two different...
No. The Kilimanjaro National Park is, as a matter of fact, Tanzania, start there, is a very interesting country. Now, Moshi is poor. Their GDP is about 6,700, about, you know, one-tenth of the U.S. And you can sort of see it in the construction, the people selling to you on the street. You know, if you've traveled at all, you know what I'm talking about in Latin America or Central America or any Middle Eastern country where... You can see it much more than, you know, around Champaign-Urbana. But and Kilimanjaro National Park is along with Arusha National Park and a couple of others I can't think of right now. Tanzania as a country has done a very good job of setting aside wilderness areas or areas that they...
But some of this... bridges into Kenya, too. Right?
Well, at the very northern edge of the slope of the mountain is the northern border. And as a matter of fact, Kenya was made that border because, like most Middle Eastern and African countries, they're made-up countries. The British and the French decided where the borders were going to go. And Tanzania itself has about 120 different tribes. It's a huge number. Like the Chaka tribe is on the Mount Kilimanjaro slopes, and the Maasai are up north. And the Samal are down south, and the Duma, which is, I guess, the Cheetah tribe, is, you know. And they're all put together. And I will say this. I actually talked to a... son of a chieftain who was in politics there. And the politics of Tanzania are very calm. They all get along together. I mean, I know that's, you know, overstating the case, but because I'm sure there are some tribal disputes over land.
There have been some huge
and there's
wars
probably,
in those countries.
Oh, well, you know, you get up north into Somalia, Ethiopia. Yeah, they're still fighting tribe to tribe. And, you know, and then it gets beyond that and becomes a political issue. You know, who owns the power in the country, and the borders don't move, and that sort of thing. But anyhow, I say Tanzania is very friendly. Everybody, you know, gets along, and there is a happiness quotient. If you want to go with Bhutan or one of the other countries, that uses that, you know. But they are poor. As a matter of fact, when you go into Mount Kilimanjaro National Park, there is a fee. And the fee is a sliding fee. And if you are an East African, it's pennies. For Americans to go into the park and climb the mountain, it costs considerably more. It ain't cheap.
It ain't cheap to get there in the first place.
Well, yeah, that's
you
the other thing.
Plane.
You go by through Amsterdam on KLM, which, you know, good airline, everything. That all worked out fine. You know, if you fly at all.
You fly directly into Tanzania?
From... yeah, you fly into Kilimanjaro International Airport from Amsterdam. So it's a two-leg flight.
So it is a tourist attraction in a way.
Yes. As a matter of fact, this is kind of a problem. They get about 55,000 visitors a year to the national park. And the national park around it up north because, of course, it's also where people go for safaris. To look at wild animals. And I did that while I was there and saw herds of giraffe and herds of zebras and warthogs. And I went to a smaller national park called Arusha that's very near there, and it's small enough that they have gotten rid of all the predator animals. So no elephants, no lions, no cheetahs, things of that sort, but all the flock animals, flock herd animals. Well, and flock too, because, man, they had, it must have been 100,000 pink flamingos. I mean, it was an incredible number. So at the base down in the town of Moshi in Arusha National Park, it is jungle, and it is, you know, stereotypically that way. Very green, lots of, even though there was a dry season, there were lots of flowers blooming, lots of different colors of different things. And again, yeah, baboons.
And it's original
and
or it's regrowth? Is this slash and burn territory?
You know, I don't know about the national park. It may be, you know, they may have set the national park aside early enough that it might be. But no, as you drive to it, you're in corn country. I mean, it was, matter of fact, they were just about to harvest because their corn had already turned brown and was sitting on the stalks, and, you know, they were praying that no rain was going to come, and the farmers are much more hand. Oh man, all I could think of is if
so
this
farms are huge farms owned by
I don't know about the ownership, but you can know the farms themselves work on a small farm
basis.
So you
still have rural sociology that's small style.
As a matter of fact, when we were there, the beans had already come in and the wheat, and literally they would lay it on half acre large plots out in front of their house to let it dry, and then would sweep it up and bag it up and put it away.
If you harvest early, you might have 27% water.
Yeah.
And you have to bring it down to something like 14%.
Yeah, so they have to dry it out.
It'll mold.
Yeah.
So they have big bins that they store it in after that?
I assume, yeah, they weren't at the storage space.
They don't have a shipping situation, so most of the food is consumed locally?
No, they ship out. As a matter of fact, I brought some coffee beans home with me, and you know, I could have brought
coffee would be in the forest.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Under the forest canopy.
Yeah, you can't grow it out where you grow corn, for sure. yeah, no, I've been to coffee plantations before, and interesting plant. But that's another discussion.
Okay.
Yeah, we can talk about the banana and the coffee bean and all the other things that have ruined countries around the world and flowers, you know, but or, you know, what they end up growing to earn a lot of money from, depending on how you look at it. So
you start out with the forest, and you have trees that you can't put your arm around.
Oh, huge, huge cypress trees and banyan trees and a lot. And I say
fig trees.
Oh, and ferns the size of this room. Just absolutely incredible. And I say
tree ferns.
And ground. Yeah, that grow up. They look very much like fiddleheads, only they're like, you know, fiddleheads from the land of the giants. And it is lush, but you walk out of that pretty quickly. And you get into sort of a scrub growth, moorland type stuff.
Dry sclerophyll, perhaps.
Yeah, and definitely plants that are living on a lot less water. Because as you walk up this 19,000-foot mountain, the highest water in the mountain is only at 12,000 feet. So once you get above that, you're carrying water, and you really don't want
to. So is this an edaphic situation? Edaphic means that the soil has something to do with the moisture, and so I assume that this is a retired volcano.
Exactly.
And therefore the soil will be basaltic.
Yes.
So as long as you're on the volcano, you will have a rich jungle.
Yeah.
And as you go up, you will get this dry sclerophyll, but you still have rich soil underneath.
And it's very distinct. It's like, you know, the snow line out west or something of that sort. You walk, I mean, when you're at, you walk up 250, 500 feet, and all of a sudden it just changes. It's a whole new growth of plants and animals, too. But then, you know, you'll walk through this incredibly dry atmosphere, this dry trail, and you'll walk under some rocks where moss and water are leaking out.
So you're mentioning rocks. Is this like a breccia? Is this where the volcano comes up and then some of it falls in on itself, so you get rocks spewed out? What is the geology of that?
Okay, at the base, in the moorland region that you would call it, it is the plant life that sort of dictates the ground and the way the mountain looks. Uh-huh. Okay, because one of the things is we stayed at Shira Plateau, which is, I don't even know how high it is.
So it's the top, but it's, you're talking about a plateau?
But you walk up, and then you get to this plateau that is literally 10 miles big around you. It's this huge expanse of just flatness before the mountain starts up again. And then the mountain starts up again. So, and when you get to the top, you realize you're in a caldera. It is the top of a volcano, and there's, you know, again, a huge expanse. This was a huge volcano at one time. And like all volcanoes, they're not going to say it's extinct yet. It just hasn't done anything in recorded history.
Rumble with little steam fumaroles?
There's none of that. Okay. If you go out to Yellowstone or somewhere like that, you know that sulfuric smell, and yeah, there are other places that are like that. No, this is definitely dormant, definitely dead at this point. And again, as you go up, it becomes more volcanic rock. And almost pure volcanic when you get to the very top. You can see where the glaciers used to run. So there's, you know, rock beds that flow down.
So U-shaped valleys rather than V-shaped.
With rock moraine type vents around it.
Now, you've, in the course of this show, you've said both equatorial and glacier.
Yes.
Glaciers have existed at the equator of this planet? I mean, sorry to be really dumb on.
No.
When I see pictures of the glaciers, you see that they almost got as far south as southern Illinois, and then they receded. You're saying at some point there were glaciers that the ice age was dense enough that even equatorial Earth had them.
So as you go up in altitude, you lose, a degree centigrade for every 500 feet or something like that. So it cools real fast.
If you're in Mexico, Popocatépetl is a typical mountain. As you go up, it
any of these, I say the seven summits, the tallest peaks in the world, you are going to hit snow at the top. Mm-hmm. Now, Kilimanjaro is interesting, and this is why I get so many tourists, is because there are glaciers at the top of something that is sitting like within a degree or a couple of degrees of the equator. But when you go up to 19,000 feet, the snow is hundreds of feet thick up there, and it's been there for a long time. What is there? What I'm saying is all the posters that you see of Kilimanjaro, even the pictures like in Wikipedia or something like that, show a lot more snow than there actually is right now. Mm-hmm. It's down to three or four different glaciers. There's the north, there's the south, there's the Arrow Glacier, and they've all sort of separated where at one time it would have been a snow-covered peak.
It is getting enough water to provide the snow that consolidates to a glacier.
It falls on it. Yeah, there's nothing that flows out. Well, you know, they don't have winter per se. They have the dry season and the rainy season. So I say, looking at the way the corn is, that their rainy season would have been 4 or 5 months ago. So back in, their rainy season, like a lot of equatorial, probably runs through March, April, and then it dries out and stays dry until November, December, later than that, maybe.
So it's interesting that people get used to the rainy season. They walk around in clothes that dry on them.
And you just learn to deal with it. I've been in places where I've been there in the rainy season, and you will have monsoon-type rains in the middle of the day where literally, if you're driving a car, you just sort of stop your car and wait for it to stop because windshield wipers can't move fast enough. Now, again, when we were there, it's the dry season. And once we got up above, I say, the moorlands into what I call a real lunar landscape. I mean, the only thing that really lives at the top of the mountain is the spider. Somehow it gets some prey, but we never saw anything.
There's probably bacteria and fungi and other creatures under there.
That have
yet to be discovered.
Oh, and, you know, and again, the snow, the water, there were glacial lakes up there.
And actually, the rain brings in organisms sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Actually, sometimes when it's a huge tornado, you can get frogs lifted up into the atmosphere and dumped on a different
ecosystem. Oh, yeah. This particular trip, I was a guinea pig for the Mayo Clinic out of Minnesota and other places around the world. And they've done experiments at Denali and other places about altitude acclimatization, because the lack of oxygen does affect you. Oh, it definitely
so
does.
So
you
were wearing apparatus?
I was wearing little devices that would give them information. Yeah, I signed my HIPAA form and all that stuff. But yeah, which meant, you know, and I joke with people, it's the future of medicine, because, you know, I get my blood pressure checked, or, you know, they check me out every time I see the doctor, you know, and that's what, once every year, every couple of years, and most of my life wasn't even that often.
Uh-huh.
You know, these people got more information about, out of me in 12 days than than my doctor has gotten in 20 years.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, with part of the problem with little devices like that is battery power.
Mm.
They'll collect lots and lots of information. I mean, they took my blood oxygen level, my skin galvanic response, my breathing, my carbon output, you know, all the time. But it takes a lot of battery power to collect that information and to store it. And, you know, right now it's designed for in-hospital use. But someday I can see where, you know, your doctor will say, here, wear this for a while, and we'll see, you know, what we get back, what the data
yes,
is.
Yes, it's called data collection, and we're able process it as we
see, now I hiked with the people that collected this data, so I trust them. But I'm not going to give it to anybody. So that's another show, too.
So when you get to the top, is there a visitor center there? I'm thinking of Ayers Rock in the middle of Australia, where there tended to be a visitor center on top of this Aboriginal monument. And they've shifted the visitor center a few miles away, but people drink their champagne and whatnot and watch Ayers Rock, but people used to crawl all over Ayers Rock. So how is the relationship between the ecosystem and the human population that probably regards?
Well, I will say this. The relationship between the ecosystem and humans is like it is pretty much every other trail or every other footpath that I've been on, is that the more people there are, the more trash there is, the more human activity is seen. And I say, so I said there were about 55,000 people that went to the national park. There's about 15,000 that actually go up to the top and climb the mountain, and or attempt to climb the mountain. And even that's a huge, think about that, 15,000 people. Now, but that's because Kilimanjaro is probably the most accessible by far of the seven summits. Doesn't take any technical climbing. It is walking, it's hiking to the top.
Yeah.
I don't need an ice axe. I don't need, crampons. I don't need rocks and beaners and, all, you know, chocks and beaners and ropes and all that stuff.
So
a lot more people do this than Everest or Anagongwa or, you know, any of the Denali or any of the other big mountains.
Even
Mount Blanc in the middle of
Outside Europe. WEFT the other day, I was talking to someone who had a son that went to one of the Darwinian sites. And he felt really embarrassed because he felt that humans should not be on this very small ecosystem.
Yeah. You know, the people who, the International Organization for the UN says that 15,000, 16,000, 18,000, I think they say that is still less than the mountain could handle and sustain ecological damage.
So
now, a lot of it is because there's nothing there. I mean, as long as you stay on the trail, the rocks are not going to wear away anytime soon.
But I'm sure we would say something different if we were sentient spiders. We would say, stay away! No!
Yeah.
1,000 is too many. You're disturbing that habitat for those minuscule.
And exactly. I mean, people, one of the things you have to understand is you're going to leave a mark. You know, I didn't leave anything on the mountain, but I'm sure that, you know, my footprints are there, and there is a mark that I did.
Talking
pass.
About footprints,
everybody does.
How many pairs of shoes did you wear? Some of these Rocks are pretty abrasive on shoes.
You know, so they make shoes.
And climb up the volcanic things, you can wear out a pair of shoes on the way.
No, I took a brand new pair this time, and they came back. I can still use them. I've worn out. As a matter of fact, the particular shoes I'm wearing, I bought three pair of them because they fit my foot perfectly. And let me tell you, foot problems, if you're going to hike, are a problem. I don't care how good your boot fits. You know, especially one of the wonderful things about Kilimanjaro this time of year is that it is the dry season. You don't have to worry about rain at all. Yes. Now, I took, a jacket, but...
I grew up with monsoons, the lower end of monsoons. So you walked around in bare feet. So your body got used to having a half-inch sole.
Yeah, well...
On your feet.
Yeah, so I say, but, once your feet get wet, it changes the way your shoes fit, and you're going to get blisters or whatever. But it didn't happen here. As a matter of fact, I was in pretty good shape, so even though every step I took for a week was higher in altitude than the one before.
So you have a knee problem, I think, too.
It goes away. My knee only hurts when I don't exercise. When I do exercise, that problem goes away. So
exercise is wonderful.
Right now, it's not a problem. Somewhere around Christmas, after I get lazy at Thanksgiving and eat way too much food, and never mind. Okay. I was there with a group from the Mayo Clinic that was put together by a professor here at the university. 28 people were poked and prodded and specimenized and all sorts of things for several weeks. And we did this slower than the usual trek. Most people go up and back in 7 or 8 days. There's a cost to being up there every day, so the faster you can do it. As a matter of fact, the guy a couple of years ago, or maybe last year, who hiked all 7 summits in 1 year, he went up and back in 18 hours. But he literally ran up and ran down. One of the things about Kilimanjaro National Park is that they require you to have porters and guides if you go. Even if you're going to hike by yourself, you still have to have someone to go with you. Again, this is not uncommon. The Inca Trail does the same thing.
Yes.
You have to have people with you, and probably there's places around
the world. Himalayas do the same.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You definitely have to have Sherpas in Himalayas. That's part of the requirement of being inside the park. Same thing here. So we had porters. And let me tell you, it's real nice to have someone else carry some of the weight off your back. And these guys are professionals. They're wonderful.
They use donkeys or
no?
No team.
They are themselves,
they put
stuff on top their heads, which at first we're thinking, it must be awful. But you realize after a while, these guys are carrying incredible amounts of weight, and their posture is probably better than it is me as a backpacker. Yes. Leaning forward a bit.
Sure, centered.
Yeah, yeah. The center, if you hold your head upright, it's your spine and your muscles are supporting everything.
Chiropractor approved.
Well, I'm not sure. I would have to practice. Okay, and the other thing, of course, is their sense of balance. To balance something on top of your head, I'd have to stand here like this and the blood would rush out of my... I'd have to hold my hands up and the blood would rush out of my hands in just a few minutes.
So you get to know your porter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Calvin and Francis, and these are the people that carried up. And because this was an experiment, and there was a lot of medical equipment that went with it. There were a lot more porters than usual. Now the porters, the particular group that we went with, run by a marvelous man, Wilfred, but Kelly Trax was the name of it. Hired all of this, did everything, put together the food, got the water up the mountain above that 12,000-foot level because, you're still going to need lots of water for 28 people and lots of food and lots of everything else. And we were all experiment. It was an experiment. It was a research project.
So did you get a concession for entrance to the park because you were a research group?
No.
No,
of course not, because we can afford it.
You had money, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
You've got to pay.
So where did you all come from?
We probably should have gotten charged more. But
where did you all come from?
Where is what?
Where did all the participants in this experiment?
Oh, well, okay. The man is in the College of Business who put this together, Paul Magelli.
At the U of I. And it's his friends.
As a matter of fact, I've got a picture of myself with the other eight people from the University of Illinois and alumni and all that are at the top of Mount Kilimanjaro. So, yeah, back to the top. When you get to the top, it does get really dry. Every foot is just kicking up dust, and you know, that becomes a breathing problem, not to mention the fact at 19,000 feet, you can feel it in your lungs. My legs were okay. You know, I got oxygen to my muscles after it was processed, but you breathe really, really hard. During the day, like right now, I can moderate my breathing. As I talk, but at night, my body would fall into the breathing mode of how I, the autonomous breathing system that I would have at 640 feet here in Champaign. And I would wake up gasping for air because I just wasn't getting enough oxygen.
Did they carry oxygen in case?
We had some just in case, but the object of this study was acclimatization. And I say we were with a couple of people that had done Everest and done it without oxygen.
So is this med school stuff here? I mean, is the people from the University of Illinois, are they part of the new med school doing PhDs and MDs at the same time and doing research on this sort of information?
No. No, they're not.
It'll go back to...
Because at this point, the medical facility here or the agreement between Carl and the university, I think we're still at the administration level and we haven't actually hired the worker bee, so to speak.
Yes, but they do have a program for people who are doing both degrees.
Yeah, yeah. But I say, I think the startup of the U of I co-sponsorship is just now starting, but... No, this and I say it was kind of interesting because, when I was at about 14,000 feet, I had real trouble sleeping. As I joked with people, walking was easy, sleeping was tough, because I say I'd wake up and I say one night, my brain was just in the middle of the night you think thoughts and in the morning you're like, really? I thought that was true. So I knew that at one point, about 1 o'clock in the morning, if I fell back asleep, that I'd never wake up because I'd quit breathing.
Wow.
But of course that's not true because I would wake up gasping again. But after my body got used to it. And as I got higher on the mountain, I had no problem sleeping. Could do it quite well.
Yes, you have to.
And hiking, I say, you breathe a whole lot harder and you take slower steps. As a matter of fact, in the Swahili language, the walking is pole pole, meaning slowly, slowly.
Bodies do that. I used to work with beekeepers in vacation, so I'd take perhaps 30 days to be able to accept bee stings, and then you get used to it.
Yeah, and then there is a point where it does you in again.
Yes, too much of it.
Yeah. No, I've known beekeepers who can't be around bees anymore because they got it too much or, their body developed a... Yeah. But, I joke that's what happened to me because, living out west, you're at, 10,000 feet and never had any problem. It was those silly people from Champaign that had problems with high altitude. Well, I say to when I was at somewhere around 12,000, 13,000 feet, I was having trouble breathing. I'm thinking, oh no, I've become one of those.
Rest of the crowd came from where?
Mayo has clinics all around. Scottsdale, Arizona, Rochester, Minnesota, Melbourne.
Uh-huh.
Australia. Yeah. You ever heard of that?
No.
From Griffith University there. And they have a clinic or people they work with there. Other people from Chicago, from Champaign, from Montana,
Europeans.
from Switzerland, from Poland, from England. I think that's about it. Yeah. Uh-huh.
How many of the folks come from places that were of comparable altitude, 10,000 feet or above? Switzerland? they've got mountains there.
Yeah, there were a couple of Swiss.
Minnesota.
As a matter of fact, the the person who has hiked the most of the seven summits, as a matter of fact, his unofficial title is Mr. North Face because he leads the North Face climbing team. Conrad Anker, there have been a couple of movies made about him, climbing Everest and Meru and K2 and Denali and different things. I forget what. But yeah, Conrad was the expert on this from a hiking standpoint. Yeah, great guy. Yeah, when I was a kid, I always wanted to hang out with, these big climbers and rock climbers and that sort of stuff. But when I was 20 years old, I was too embarrassed to actually talk to them. You know, now I'm like, screw it. Well, it turns out that they're nice people, you know, these celebrities, these rock climbing and hiking celebrities.
Yeah. Well, now that you're at the top, how do you say hi to the Maasai? Where are the ethnic groups that own the mountain?
As a matter of fact,
metaphysically,
the particular group that the particular guide that we chose is kind of unusual in that he will pick porters and guides from all the different tribes. He's dealing with probably, 70 to 100 people, porters. They are getting paid $6 to $8 a day. Wilfred's nice and pays 10 to over that per day of work. And it is work where you're going to be away from your family. You know, if you're earning money, you're away from your family. And there is a movement to start a union of sorts to help these people get better paid, to help them get educated. Yes, education is a big issue.
The Himalayan guides have been doing the same thing.
Yeah, the Sherpa.com or .org or whatever, same thing here in Tanzania. So,
I'm still
they do need some help because, it's a tough job. They're carrying my stuff. So I'm feeling guilty about that to start with. And then, can't pay them. And I know what the pay is that they're getting for doing that. And no American would put up with that. So, you leave extra money at the end, of course, tips. But, if they do a really good job, which they do. We're a few white guys in a country of, I was going to say African Americans, but they're African. And I didn't even think about it until like a couple of days before we left. I realized there was absolutely zero prejudice, in any way, shape, or form from any group. It sounds so Stephen Colbert-ish, but you kind of forget the color of the people that you're with. And you really do.
So how did you communicate within the group?
English is the lingua franca. Uh-huh. There have only been about three or four places in the world that I've been that people don't know enough English that you can communicate. Mm. Now, one of my porters, his English was very bad. Another was excellent. Some people are better at foreign languages than others. Uh-huh. It's kind of interesting because the Swahili language runs up and down the east coast of Africa.
But it's different in different places.
Yes, and they can't really understand each other. Yeah, the northern Tanzanians have trouble understanding the southern Tanzanians. Once you get out of the country and into other tribal units, they all have their own dialect. I say it's kind of interesting.
And that's not really – I have had a hard time understanding people from Savannah, Georgia.
Well, but it's different than
that. Oh, my God. Yeah. Where do these people come from? Where does that accent come from? I mean, Donna, I can understand you, and you've got an accent from us northern. But Savannah is its own
– Well, and the other thing, of course, Swahili. Is if you can pick out my particular accent, you know exactly which state or area I'm from. Although most people just say, oh, he's got a southern twang, but there's more to it than that. I would never be mistaken for somebody from Alabama
or Texas. Yeah,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You're not. No, you're not from Texas.
Still thinking about the picture of the Maasai with a spear
and the robes. Let me tell you, it exists. Those people do exist as you're walking around.
They are
cattle and goat and sheep herders. The Maasai, that's
animal,
been their thing.
They're not vegetarians in any way.
No. And then I say the Chukka tribe is the tribe that was on the slopes of Kilimanjaro. Then there's southern tribes that, their claim to fame was that they were wood carvers. an artist, and I brought back a wood carving that I really, really like. And, you know, they all had their own tribal identities, and they still do, although it's now being merged, of course, because that's the communication is so much better than it was, you know, 100 years ago. But they still have that tribal identity, you know, that says, you know, this was my dad, or, you know, this is what we do, that sort of thing.
What was the balance between men and women?
Oh, there are men porters. Now, I asked when we first started out if there were any women porters, and they said yes, but our group, the other groups, the other, you know, half a dozen groups we saw on the mountain, all men.
How about the group itself?
Oh, the group, our group?
Yes.
Half and half, maybe. Maybe not quite. More men than women. Maybe I'm overstating. I don't know. I didn't think about that.
So you did other things since summer. You went back to the Appalachian Trail, and we have about 10 minutes left.
I was going to say, should we just have you come back next week to cover that one? Because we've only got 10 minutes here.
Well,
so
it is something I could talk for another 50 minutes, another hour about.
Yes.
Maybe we stick with Africa this time and America.
Yeah, because, okay, so you get to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, and you walk between the glaciers. And the first thing you hit is a sign that says, congratulations, you're at Uhuru Peak. Uhuru. By the way, it's amazing the number of Swahili words that you find that you know. Because, of course, in the Walt Disney movies, the name of the animal is the name of the animal. Uh-huh. Like lion is Simba. All of a sudden my mind goes blank. I can't think of any of the Timbo is the elephant. And, you know, of course. But the interesting one is Uhuru. Remember Uhura?
Uhura from Star Trek, of course. Yeah. Like
it's
peace?
It means peace in Swahili, mm-hmm. Yeah. Gene Roddenberry chose that
it's
name specifically
that the
for
Australians,
that.
If I finish my phone call to my brother in Australia, it's Huru.
Okay, yeah. And that's the other thing, of course, when you listen to languages around the world, there are certain things that, wait a second, did they just speak in my language? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, but it gets really close sometimes. But, Santi Sana, you learn that. That's thank you very much, because I say if you have porters, they're constantly doing work for you in different ways. They purified all the water. And again, when you're trying to get that much water up a mountain, I'm glad someone else had to carry that. And someone did cooking for me. I didn't have to cook for myself. You know, that's part of this whole process. Now, I could have, you know, taken my jet boil stove up and done that, but big mountain climbing, seven summit climbing, it's a whole different world from walking the Appalachian Trail by yourself, or even, you know, I do long distance hiking. I've been on trails where literally in a month I've seen maybe one or two other people on the trail. And back to the amount of trash. The more people, the more trash. I can always tell how many people walk a trail by, you know, what's along it.
Is that a matter of education? Can you have a trail that's very heavily used, but everyone brings out their trash?
Let me put it this way. The Appalachian Trail is probably one of the best maintained trails because of the sheer number of people that walk up and down it. Uh-huh. But there's still trash on it, no matter what. There's always, and believe me, I've had evil discussions with people, but that's another story too. Again, then people who actually climb to the top of Mount Kilimanjaro understand the landscape that they're in. And once you heard it, it doesn't get better. You know, if I want to tear down a tree in the Appalachians, you know, a generation from now, there'll be another tree there. It's enough water. It's a temperate rainforest. Up there, nothing grows, nothing changes. As a matter of fact, you can go out to Joshua Tree National Park in California, and there is an area where Patton's tank trails. You can still see where they practiced desert training out there before World War II.
Yes.
And they're still there in the sand.
The Passways West, you can still see the grooves where the covered wagons went.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there's my wife did work on the Oregon Trail, And yeah, the same sort of thing. The wagon wheel ruts are still there 100 years later, because you know there are parts of this world that just don't change.
So tell me a little bit about the national parks. Some of these countries, like Australia, didn't have a national park system for a long time. The U.S. didn't have a national park system for. What is the African situation?
Well, Tanzania has been a free country now only since the late 60s, early 70s, and started their national park system at that time. And parliamentary, they're an old British protectorate, so they use the shilling as their unit of currency. They drive on the wrong side of the road, you know. Kind of like those Australians, you know.
One of the things that grew without there being an academic base for national park work and things like that is that people who were self-trained, who had a lot of knowledge about a park, mm-hmm. would be the ones that would be the chiefs.
Or
then in Australia, they decided to only employ degreed people to do this. And all of a sudden, those wunderkinds left. That partially was because it was felt that they had a one-track mind because they'd grown up with a one-track mind.
Well, it's kind of interesting because, it's not like that in Tanzania. As a matter of fact, the porters, the lowest rung, they want to become a guide. And guides, actually, you know, you have to know a lot of English and German and Chinese and different languages because you are working with the clients, the people going up the hill, myself. Uh-huh. And then from there, most of the guides that I talked to, their goal was to become a ranger in the parks, to actually work for the national parks and work with the animal husbandry or work on, you know, plant and flora. And by the time they're a guide, they've probably walked. One of them said that he had been to the top of Kilimanjaro 20 times, and you know, halfway up the mountain, you know, he can't even count. So these are people who know the land, know what it's like to deal with tourists on the land as well, which I think is very important because, yeah, I mean, that's why we have national parks, is so people who don't know anything. Can learn.
Learn, yes.
And those that do know something can learn and teach. Yeah. I thank you very much for inviting me to this show because, yeah, I hope somebody listens to this and wants to ask a little more or find out a little bit more.
Let me have a look at the time. We've got about 2 minutes. We should do just a little bit more fundraising for WEFC.
Oh, yeah, 217-359-9338. I'll answer the phone. And so will Dave.
It's Pledge Drive, and we're trying to keep...
keep us on the air.
On the air.
Yeah. And good programming like the Prairie Monk.
Like this. You're never going to hear this on... I won't give any letters, but, you know, no other station in this town does what you're hearing right here, right now on this station. You happen to have tuned in, and in fact, in the future, you could even be listening to this because this will be up on YouTube within weeks and such. So you can, even after our own pledge drive is over, you can always make a pledge to WEFT at 217-359-9338 or go to our website. I know there are shy people who don't like that. I know I have a very dear friend who has taken to ordering food. She gets her ingredients mailed to her so she doesn't have to go to the store and have to hand money over to some person to buy those same ingredients. If you're like that, that's perfectly okay. Go to our website, weft.org, and make your pledge there, and we won't bother you. You won't have to talk to us.
So is there any one thing that you might want to say before we've got 2 minutes?
Follow your dream. Do something. I don't. It may not be Kilimanjaro. This was something I wanted to do when I was in my 20s, and somehow life got in the way. And my wife, actually, Susan, actually talked me into this, or helped talk me into this. So,
didn't go.
Do it.
Yes. Or bicycle. Bicycling is good too.
Yeah, one of the things about life is early when we were in our 20s, we said the key to life is time and money. We were all entrepreneurs, so when you had lots of time. You probably didn't have much money because you weren't earning any. When you had lots of money, you were working your tail off. Now that I'm older, in my 60s, time, money, and health. Because we have friends who have lost their health. And I'm still at the point in my life where I've got a kind of a good mix of those three. And as a college...
Do you convey this to your finance students?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, believe me, they talk about Professor Davis's rants, I found out. Because that's another one of those things.
Well,
if you're not pissed off, you're not paying attention.
This is Dave Monk.